Okay, let me say something as we're about to get started here. I'm sure that some of you have gotten your papers back that I created. Normally, what I do, normally I write out a list of things that help you when you write them in the future, different things that I use for grading them. And I wanted to mention that today because I didn't take the time to write it down, even though I'll often do that. But I don't have time to write down little comments on your paper. I wish I did. But sometimes there's so much to do that I don't have time to take the personal attention that really needs to be taken. But let me just kind of give you some direction. You may have gotten your paper back, and you may have felt like, well, I really felt like this was a good paper, and I didn't get that good of a grade. So what is it that the teacher is really looking for? What am I looking for that would have maybe detracted from your grade a little bit? Well, number one, one of the primary things is content. I look down through the paper. I do read them. But I look down through the paper, and I speed read them. I do that. But I read down through it, and I find, does it flow in thought? Is it something that is written in a clear fashion? And as far as content, does it basically fulfill the requirements that I gave in class to elaborate a little bit on each of these different groups? So that's one criteria right there. Now, there's a second one that I use, and that's neatness. And neatness is a big thing with me. If there's any crossed out words on the paper, there's any crossed out words, there's no way that I would ever give an A or an A minus to any paper that had crossed out words on it. And the reason why is because there's like corrector tape and there's white out that you can use, and you can cross over words and you can white over them, or you can use tape and you can rewrite the word. And so if you have X'd out words on it, well then see, the best grade that I would probably give a paper like that is B+. And the reason that I do that is for you to learn to be a little bit more neat and a little bit more careful. Now also with spelling mistakes, in fact sometimes what I'll do, I didn't do it on this particular assignment, but I will go through the paper and I will circle the spelling errors that I see. And then also another thing I look for is the paper staple. Is it typed? If the paper is typed, its chances are it will get a better grade than if it's handwritten, although I have given handwritten assignments good grades if they're real neat. And if you have trouble writing, then you might have to take the time to print, see, so that it's real legible. Does it have a cover title on it? Another big thing is my name spelled right. If you spell my name wrong, that's a blow against you right off the bat. And a teacher cannot help that. If his name is spelled wrong, you know, and I've had students, and this is the gospel truth, I've had them write my name, and then they went to hand it into my box, and they could see that my name was different, and I'm assuming this is what happened now, but at any rate, they crossed my name out, and they wrote the correct spelling below it. But I've seen it, like, crossed out twice, and then below that, my correct spelling. Because my name is a hard name to spell right off the top. You know, it has a couple silent letters in it. And even my wife, almost before we got married, spelled my name wrong before. So I can understand how you can spell my name wrong. But still, I feel like if a student's going to hand in an assignment, then he needs to write the teacher's name down correctly. And so that's another point. And these are all things that add up. So normally, by the time you're done looking at all those different things and evaluating them, normally you can get pretty much a ballpark grade for the student. Now, granted, there's a certain amount of subjectivity that enters in. There's a certain amount of I suppose, personal weakness on the part of the teacher, not being able to evaluate it and weigh everything flawlessly. But I think after a number of years, a teacher becomes fairly good at being able to evaluate these assignments and grade them with, I think, a fair amount of consistency. So those are the things that I was really looking for. Also, if you added a little bibliography at the back, well then see, that's another plus on your paper. So you may have written a real good paper as far as content, but it may not have been legible, or you may have crossed out words on it, and it may not have been real systematically arranged, and so therefore, see, that would be a couple marks against you right there. But whatever you've got on your assignment, please do not take it personally. In fact, often what I will do this very, very often, I will not even look at the name of the student. Now, sometimes you can't help it, but often I will skip the title page and purposely not look at the name because I do not want to be influenced by friendships, or I do not want to be influenced in any way like that. You know, maybe a student has written me a nice note or something before. Well, now I don't want to give him a good grade because I feel obligated to give him on that basis. So very, very often, see, I will not even look at the name of the student. And I try to be as fair as I possibly can. Now, we need to have a little quiz on Greece and Rome. A little quiz on Greece and Rome. Hopefully this won't be too much of a grief to your spirit. One of these days, my brother, your testings and trials will all be over. Yes? No. We haven't talked about this for a little while. So, the one day you decided to come to class, right? You picked the right day. Fate was with you. The wind was blowing in your sails. You glided into the proper harbor. Here you are, predestined from the foundation of the world to be in room 701 at precisely this time, 10 minutes after 10. Aren't you graced with good fortune? Okay, a quiz on Greece and Rome. And it looks like most of it is pretty much just a short little answer here, and it's pretty much either know it or you don't, I guess. Yes, just a sheet of paper. It's not a major test at all. It's just a little oral quiz, what it is. Hey, Jeff, I need to talk to you before class. It's over, right. Make sure you catch me so I don't run off. I need only about a half a minute. I've got to ask you something about Kirkland. Number one. Number one is, what were the two dominant geographical features in the life of every Greek? What are the two dominant, off to a rip-roaring start, I can tell by the look on your face. What are the two dominant geographical features? Now, geographical, it has to do with the land. What two dominant land features were in the life of every Greek? I talked about this. In other words, what was it about the land of Greece that affected the life of every single Greek person as they grew up? What two things about the land? What two aspects of their geography were in their life? What other way can I say it? What were the two dominant geographical features in the life of every Greek? Two different things that played a part in their life. Okay, number two. Which Athenian philosopher was the personal teacher of Alexander the Great? Which famous Athenian philosopher? What's an Athenian? From Athens. Which Athenian philosopher was the personal teacher of Alexander the Great? Personally taught and tutored Alexander for years. Famous, famous Greek philosopher. Then number three, just slow me down if I start going too fast here. Number three, what is the spread and development of Greek culture throughout the world called? There's a certain technical name that we gave that concept. What is the spread and development of Greek culture throughout the world called? What is the name of that term? The spread and the development of Greek culture throughout the world. What is that called? Now, number four, following the death of Alexander, his kingdom was divided amongst four generals. Who controlled the land north of Palestine, the land of Syria? What was the name of that general that controlled the land north of Palestine in Syria? Following the death of Alexander, his kingdom was divided amongst four generals. Who controlled the land of Syria, north of Palestine? And then there's a second part. Who controlled the land of Egypt, south of Palestine? Which Greek general? Same question, yes. Same question, number four. So following the death of Alexander, his kingdom was divided amongst four generals. Who controlled Syria, the land north of Palestine? And who controlled Egypt, the land south of Palestine? Which two generals? What were their names? Number five, what is the name of the wicked Greek who sought to destroy the Jews and their religion? His reign led to the Maccabean revolt. He was a very wicked king. He was a very ungodly man. He was actually a type or a picture of the coming Antichrist. But what was his name? Do you remember his name? What's the name of the wicked Greek? Please remember his name. I'll get down on my knees and beg. Please remember. What is the name of the wicked Greek who sought to destroy the Jews and their religion, and his reign led to the Maccabean revolt? Isn't it amazing how you feel like you've never even taken the class and you wonder if you're even in the right room? What is the name of the wicked Greek who sought to destroy the Jews and their religion? His reign led to the Maccabean revolt. Okay, number six. Who was the first absolute ruler or emperor to lead Rome out of the political chaos after the collapse of the Republic? So this is the first main dictator that came to power in Rome. And actually, he was the first Caesar. That's another way of saying it. He was the first Caesar. Don't just put down Caesar, because Caesar just means more or less a king. That's what that title means. Yes. It's actually number six, because number one had two parts. What are the two dominant geographical features? And number four had two parts as well. Number four was, following the death of Alexander, who ruled north of Palestine, who ruled south of Palestine? Maybe you made those two separate ones. Is that what you did, you think? Okay, yeah. Okay, number six. Who was the first absolute ruler or emperor or dictator to lead Rome out of political chaos after the collapse of the Republic? So he was the first real Caesar. Well, having to do with the Roman Empire. He'd be the first one that you'd really label the Caesar. Okay, he was the first dictator to come to power. Right, the first dictator to come to power. That might be a way of looking at it. Okay, and then the next one, number seven. What do historians call the period of Roman peace from 30 BC to AD 180, when Rome flourished as a world power? What is that time of Roman peace called? There's a certain term, actually it's a Latin phrase, but what do historians call the period of Roman peace from 30 BC to AD 180, when Rome flourished as a world power? What is that called? Yes. Yeah, if you can write down that word for me. What do historians call the period of Roman peace from 30 BC to AD 180, when Rome flourished as a world power? Okay, number eight. Name the philosophy that held that man's reason was the highest good. That man should live for his reason. Man should live only by his thinking. Name the philosophy that the Romans believed in that held that man's reason was the highest good. What is that philosophy? Then number nine is, name the philosophy that held that the pursuit of pleasure was the highest good. Name the philosophy that held that the pursuit of pleasure was the highest good. And then number 10, Jesus was born during the reign of which Roman emperor? Which Caesar? Which Caesar was Jesus born under? During whose reign? So Jesus was born during the reign of which Roman emperor? What was the name of that Caesar? You can remember Luke chapter 2, and there went forth a decree that so-and-so should tax the whole world. What's his face? Number 11. How many all total? There, actually, we're going to number 15. Yeah, number 15. Oh, sure, you bet. Yes, you can. Number 11, who ruled as emperor at the time of Christ's crucifixion? So, who was Caesar when Jesus was crucified? Who ruled as emperor or as Caesar at the time of Christ's crucifixion? What was the name of the Roman emperor who ruled or reigned when Jesus was crucified? Now, number 12, list two benefits of Rome, or I should say list one of the two benefits of Roman citizenship. You only have to list one, but there were two that I believe I mentioned in class. But what were the benefits of Roman citizenship? List just one of them. I think I mentioned two. But list one of the two benefits of Roman citizenship. Okay, and then number 13 is this. Is this true or false? The first Roman emperor to extensively persecute Christians was Nero. Is that true or is that false? The first Roman emperor to extensively persecute Christians was Nero. Extensively, that means in a major way. The first Roman emperor to extensively persecute Christians was Nero. Number 14. Is this true or false? Herod the Great ruled over Palestine at the time of Christ's birth. Is that true or is that false? Herod the Great ruled over Palestine at the time of Christ's birth. Is that true or is that false? Herod the Great ruled over Palestine at the time of Christ's birth. And then number 15 for the grand finale. The destruction of Jerusalem was accomplished in AD 70 by Titus, who afterwards became emperor. The destruction of the city of Jerusalem was accomplished in AD 70 by Titus, who later on became a Roman emperor. Is that true or is that false? The destruction of Jerusalem was accomplished in AD 70 by Titus, who afterwards became emperor. True or false? Now, would you like to have me go back down through those and repeat those one more time? How many of you feel like you'd like to have me repeat them all one more time? Okay, well, I'll go back down and repeat them. Now, if you have a question on any one, well, then you listen carefully, and I'll repeat the one that you're interested in when I come to it. Number one, what were the two dominant geographical features in the life of every Greek? Number two, which Athenian philosopher was the personal teacher of Alexander the Great? Number three, what is the spread and development of Greek culture throughout the world called? Number four, following the death of Alexander, his kingdom was divided amongst four generals. Who controlled Syria and who controlled Egypt? Who controlled the land north of Palestine? Who controlled the land south of Palestine? Number five, what is the name of the wicked Greek who sought to destroy the Jews and their religion, and his reign led to the Maccabean revolt? Number six, who was the first absolute ruler, or Caesar, or emperor in Rome to lead Rome out of the political chaos after the collapse of the Republic? Number seven, What do historians call the period of Roman peace from 30 BC to AD 180 when Rome flourished as a world power? Number 8, name the philosophy that held that man's reason was the highest good. Number 9, name the philosophy that held that the pursuit of pleasure was the highest good. Number 10, Jesus was born during the reign of which Roman emperor? Okay. Number 11, who ruled as emperor at the time of Christ's crucifixion? Number 12, list one of the two benefits of being a Roman citizen. Number 13, true or false, the first Roman emperor to extensively persecute Christians was Nero. Number 14, Herod the Great ruled over the land of Palestine at the time of Christ's birth. And number 15, the destruction of Jerusalem was accomplished in AD 70 by Titus, who afterwards became a Roman emperor. Yes. Uh-huh. Some things that he did? A choice of... Oh. Well, I'll tell you what. I sympathize with your plight. I sympathize with your plight. But it becomes really kind of hard to correct tests like that, because then you have to deal with the entire class on that basis, and it's kind of hard to do that. Yeah, I could do that. I could do that, too. Well, I'll tell you, let's go ahead and let's correct this now. Now, normally what my policy has been in this class... Yes?
I never think it's still bothering me. You've got to make a distinction between the two. I mean, I know that we're saying exactly
what
you're talking about. Yeah. You're still giving up information.
Yeah. Well, I think that I have, though, because I mentioned this individual, and I said basically the very thing that I said right here on this.
Was he associated with the Roman?
Was he? Well, see, that's not really fair to tell you that, because that's too much of a hint.
Well, just give the whole question over.
Just give it to you? Okay. Who was the first absolute ruler or emperor to lead Rome out of political chaos after the collapse of the Republic? I think the real key is he's the first Roman Caesar. He's the first dictator. That's the thing that clinches it. And that's the thing that removes all the ambiguity. So he's the first Roman Caesar. Okay, now let me tell you what my policy has been in this class before, and I don't know if we'll have time to do this or not. But I did have one or two other quizzes. And normally what I did is I gave the students these two or three quizzes, and then I threw out the worst quiz. See, so like if you really blew one, well, then I just threw that out. And that, see, would not be a deterrent, would not affect your grade in a negative way then. But I don't know. Our class is shorter in time, so I'm hoping I can do that for you, you know, to give you the benefit of the doubt so that your grade isn't dependent on just a few grades. And if you blow it in one place, well, then your whole grade is negatively affected. Well, number one. Now, on a couple of these, I'm going to be a little bit lenient in correcting them, even though I asked you to give me two answers. If you just have one of them, then that's fine for me. Number one, what were the two dominant geographical features in the life of every Greek? If they have only one of these, then that's fine. They might have the other one wrong, but if they have one of these, then the answer is fine. It would be the mountains and the sea. If they got either the mountains or the ocean or the sea, or I suppose... I'm not sure what else they could put there, but either the mountains or the sea. So they only need one of those. Number two, which Athenian philosopher was a personal teacher of Alexander? Do you remember? What? Aristotle, very good. Aristotle. Number three, the spread and development of Greek culture, what is that?
Hellenism.
Hellenism. They don't have it spelled right, but basically the word is recognizable, that's fine. Number four. Following the death of Alexander, his kingdom was divided amongst four generals. Now, if they have either one of these generals, that's fine. So they only need to have one of these as well. So this one I'm going to be lenient on too. And one of them is Seleucus. Seleucus. That's spelled S-E-L-E-U-C-U-S. Seleucus. And the second was Ptolemy. P-T-O-L-E-M-Y, Ptolemy. So either one of those. Yes. If they had them reversed, well, then we'd have to mark that wrong. They had them reversed. Yes.
Well, you mean if they only have one of them?
If they only have one.
Parts A and B, if they only have one.
If they only have one correct,
the one
it's wrong.
Spell anything.
Yeah, that's fine. If they only have one correct, that's fine. Yeah. Number five, what is the name of the wicked Greek who sought to destroy the Jews and their religion? His reign led to the Maccabean revolt. His name was Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, they may have only written Antiochus because that was his name. He was actually Antiochus IV, I believe. But they may have only had Antiochus. That's fine. They may have had Epiphanes. That was fine. That'd be fine, too. But his name was Antiochus Epiphanes. Incidentally, that name means, I'm not sure if I mentioned it, the manifest one. And he believed that he was the manifest God. And the Jews actually changed one Greek letter. They changed the phi, which is transliterated as a ph, to a mu, to an m, and they called him Antiochus Epiphanes, which means the madman. So they took the name that he gave himself, changed one letter on it, and changed it into the madman. Yes.
Mike,
yes.
The word Antioch is the name of the city, but that wouldn't be quite right.
Antioch? That's what they wrote down? Antioch? Well, the city was named after him. Boy, I'm inclined to almost give that to them because it's so close that I feel like it's kind of a... You think so? I'll bet it's not your paper, though, is it? I'm almost inclined to give them that because on a quiz like this, I'm being kind of lenient. So, number six, who was the first absolute ruler to lead Rome out of political chaos after the collapse of the Republic? The first Caesar, who is that?
Julius.
Well, I feel like he was. Yeah, see, he grabbed... Huh? Well, he did grab absolute power. In fact, that's what really led to his assassination. It really made him kind of unpopular because the Romans were very, very uncomfortable having one man rule over them. They'd been used to a democracy which had been decaying for a long period of time. And in fact, when Julius Caesar was marching back to Rome from the frontier, I think I alluded to this, he marched with a large army. And the Roman Senate commanded that he disband that army because they were afraid of the power of Julius. And he came back and actually established what I suppose you might call a military coup or something like this. And for a couple of years, he was the absolute dictator. And now, number seven, what do historians call the period of Roman peace from 30 BC to AD 180? Pax Romana. Pax Romana. P-A-X-R-O-M-A-N-A. Yes. Roman peace. Well, see, that's what I asked the question for, though. I said, what do you call that period of Roman peace? That's what it means. Right. Yeah. But see, if I ask that in the question, what is this period of Roman peace called? And if you say Roman peace, well, then that really is just, it's not really the answer that we're looking for, though. I wouldn't make the answer the same thing that's in the question. Yes.
She doesn't want me to say it. I really feel bad. I like to give her credit. Roman Paxomania.
That sounds like a disease. That Roman Paxomania. Boy, we should almost count it right for ingenuity. Well, you don't have to say whose paper it was. We know it's either Ed's or Judy's. So, Judy or Julie? Judy, yes. Well, Roman Paxomania. That's, sometimes teachers are between a rock and a hard place. Roman Paxomania. Well, I know that she's got it on the tip of her tongue there, and I, Roman Paxomania. Well, maybe put a question mark on that, and I'll look at it. I'll consider it. I'll pray about it. Okay, number 8. Name the philosophy that held that man's reason was the highest good. That's Stoicism. Stoicism. Number 9, and that's spelled Stoicism, but they may have spelled it wrong. That's fine. Number 9, name the philosophy that held the pursuit of pleasure was the highest good. Epicureanism. Epicureanism, yeah. Gnosticism. Gnosticism was the philosophy that matter was evil, and therefore Jesus did not come in a body, but Jesus was an apparition. He was a lower God than Almighty God that was sent from God. And the Gnostics varied in their belief, but basically they felt that matter was evil, that the body was evil. And incidentally, that crept right into the Roman Catholic Church, and there's a lot of Gnosticism in the Roman Catholic Church where they believe that the body is evil, and therefore the body needs to, many of the early Catholics wore hair shirts, and they did all kinds of things to make their body uncomfortable because they felt that the body was evil. Mm-hmm. Oh, you're welcome. Number 10, Jesus was born during the reign of which Roman emperor? Who was that? That was Caesar Augustus. If they just have Augustus, that's fine. Augustus. Number 11, who was the emperor at the time of his crucifixion? Anyone know that? Tiberius. Tiberius, right. They don't need to have Caesar added to it either, but Tiberius is his name. Yes, that's right. Thank you. Yeah, that's right. You may have had Octavian as well for Augustus, for number 10. If they did have Octavian, then that would be fine too. Was there another name for Tiberius? I can't remember. Claudius. Claudius reigned, I think, right after Tiberius did. Right after Caligula's did? Yes, that's how it goes. It goes Tiberius, and then to Caligula, and then Claudius. Claudius reigned from AD 41 to 54. I don't remember mentioning an alternate name for Tiberius. Number 12, list one of the two benefits of Roman citizenship. Well, one would be the right to vote, and the other was protection, provided protection. They might have put something like, they could not be beaten. They could not be beaten, or something like that. That would be fine, too, because that's part of it. Yes.
Like no scourging?
No scourging, yes. Yes. They would not serve as a slave. One of the benefits of being they would not serve. Well, that's true. They would not be a slave. Yes. Right to travel where? Oh, yes. That would be fine too. Yes. The free games and the free bread. I never thought of that. Well, I guess I really can't say no to that. I guess what were the slaves? They were in the arena, fighting each other. That's what the slaves were doing. They were the gladiators. The citizens weren't the gladiators, I don't think. So I guess I'd have to mark that right too. Number 13, you got to be a little bit, open when you ask a question like this. You can't demand that the student think exactly like the teacher. They can't always do that. Number 13, the first Roman emperor to extensively persecute Christians was Nero. That's true. That's true. Number 14, Herod the Great ruled over all of Palestine at the time of Christ's birth. That's true. That's true. Number 15, the destruction of Jerusalem was accomplished in AD 70 by Titus, who afterwards became emperor. That's true. That's true. That's true. Pompey. Yes, Pompey conquered Palestine, but that was 70 years before. He was the one that came down and conquered it from the Greeks, actually, and from the Jews. Now, we're talking about AD 70, the general that came down 100 years later, see, 100 years later, and destroy Jerusalem. That was Titus.
What's the score?
Okay, just put the minus number. Just put the minus number. Just one for each one. Just one for each one. There were a couple there that I said they could have either answer or just one of the two. What do they have? Pox? You just had PAX? Oh, I don't know. I suppose that's only part of the answer. I hate to mark it wrong, but I guess it's only part of the answer, really. I guess. Yeah. Reluctant. Yeah. Yeah. Sure. Maybe stop by the chapel and have see if someone can't pray for you before you head home. Feel the flu? Hey, can you make a few chapels? Okay. Good. You better go ahead. Go. See you later. Okay, hand it back to the owner. And the owner, count up the number wrong. Make sure that the number has been tabulated correctly. Okay, let's pass these in now. Thank you. Appreciate that, Connor. Okay. Thank you for studying all these facts and all these different people. Now, let's continue our discussion today. We have a little bit of time left. We're going to be talking about, for a couple of hours here, the geography of Palestine, what the land of Palestine is actually like. Today it's kind of technical. I'm going to give you a couple technical points. A general description of the land of Palestine would be that it actually had many, many different features for such a small little land. Everything from the Dead Sea to the Sea of Galilee to the Jordan River and the Jordan River Valley and the Central Hill Country and the Transjordan Plateau and many mountains and lofty Mount Hermon to the north with snow on it, and yet land below the sea level by the Dead Sea. In fact, it goes all the way from Mount Hermon up to the north, which is about 9,200 plus feet or whatever above sea level, all the way down to about 120 miles south of that to the Dead Sea, which is 1,200, almost 1,300 feet below sea level. So there's quite an elevation variance in just a relatively short period of time. Now, Palestine is divided into four different geographical locations. And I'd like to draw a little map for you here. And I'd like to sketch this for you. And I'd like to show you these four main divisions. If you're listening on tape, I would suggest that you see someone else's tape or someone else's notes here. Okay, so we start up here, a little body of water. There are four major divisions to the land of Palestine. And what I'll do, I'll just draw a little dash for the main divisions here. And I'm going to number them for you. This. We begin with number one, go to number two, number three, and then number four. Let me tell you about each one of these real briefly. Number one is called the coastal plain. Number two is called the mountains. Number three is called the Jordan River Valley. And number four is called the Transjordan Plateau. Now I'll go back and tell you about each one of these. Number one is the coastal plain. That deals with the entire coastline of the land of Palestine, the coastal plain. It extends along the coast of Palestine with actually varying widths. North of Mount Carmel, there's a small but very fertile little plain called the Plain of Acco. The Plain of Acco. Maybe I should spell it for you. That would be this plain right north of Mount Carmel. Mount Carmel is the little land that juts out into the Mediterranean Sea there. So Acco is right up there to the north. Now right below Mount Carmel is the Plain of Sharon. The Plain of Sharon, which is a very beautiful, very, very fertile section of land. A lot of orchards are located there today. And I've seen pictures of this. During certain portions of the year, the entire thing is covered with wildflowers everywhere. Just flower after flower after flower after flower. Extremely beautiful, very, very fertile. And actually, it varies from about 6 to 12 miles in width, so it's not very big, and goes, I'm not sure, about maybe 20 miles south of Mount Carmel there, 20, 25 miles south of Mount Carmel. And then if you were to look a little bit farther down, the Plain of Philistia is down in the southern section. Hopefully you can read my handwriting there. Philistia is on the southern portion. That'd be like this section right here. Does anyone know what that's called today? Yes, that's called Gaza. The Gaza Strip, which is one of the areas that is being debated, whether the Jews actually possess and control that or not. The Plain of Philistia actually was about 20 miles in width. It was the home of the ancient Philistines. This is where the Philistines lived, just on a relatively small portion of land. But it was very fertile. They could grow good crops there. And they were the ancient enemies of Israel for a long, long period of time. Gave the Israelites a lot of trouble. Now, up to the north, again, backing up a little bit, there's another plain that cuts across the land of Palestine. It's called the Plain of Esdraelon. And we're going to be talking about this a little bit later, but actually it begins at Mount Carmel, and it cuts all the way over to the Trans-Jordan Valley, like that. It's an entire plain that is very, very fertile. It's the most fertile portion of all of Palestine, and it's called Esdraelon. I'm not sure if I should write it on here or not. Well, I'll give the other name. It's also known as the Valley of Jezreel. Jezreel, the valley or the plain of Jezreel, and Jezreel is the Hebrew word. The Greek word is Esdraelon, and I'll write down that a little bit later. We're going to study it. But the significant thing about this is where the hill Megiddo is found. Megiddo is a Hebrew word, and the word Har is added to it. It's the Hebrew word for mountain, and you come up with Har Megiddo, which is the word from which we get Armageddon. And so actually, Armageddon, the location is located in the Valley of Jezreel, right here below the Sea of Galilee. And I'll talk about that later. We'll study that. Okay, so you've got those different plains. Now, down in the southern portion, there's an area down in the southern portion by the Dead Sea that's called the Shephela. The Shephela. And, again, we're a little bit limited here for neatness. Shephela. Can you read that? Shephela, that's spelled S-H-E-P-H-E-L-A-H, the Shephela. And it's right down there in the southern portion. Now, actually, what this is, it's a series of foothills down in the southern portion. It's a very barren area. The word Shephela is a Hebrew name. It means low or lowland. And it's a series of foothills located between the coastal plain. And actually, the name that I've written goes over a little bit too far. There's actually a mountain range that cuts down right all the way through the heart of Palestine. And the Shephela runs up to this mountain range. But it's this section right here. It was kind of a buffer zone. And it's a very barren, very rugged, very arid area. If you were to go there, there'd be nothing but a few wild goats and maybe some eagles hovering overhead and a lot of limestone caves. And that's where David spent a lot of time hiding from Saul. Now the mountains, number two, is the mountains. That whole section that runs down right through the heart of the land of Palestine. They do have a mountain range. Now what they call mountains, we would call hills. But they call them mountains. For example, Megiddo is called a mountain. The Hebrew word Har means mountain. It's 70 feet tall. They call it a mountain. Well, we would not call that a mountain. A 70-foot hill, that's hardly even a hill. See? But they do call it a mountain. Actually, the mountains that run down through the heart of Palestine are a central range of mountains. They're really an extension of the Lebanon Mountains up in the northern part of Lebanon and Syria. And there are three divisions of these mountains. You could take all the mountains that run right down through the heart of Palestine, divide them up into three divisions: the mountains of Galilee, the mountains of Samaria, and the mountains of Judea. Now, with the mountains of Galilee, the mountains average about 2,800 feet tall. Now, that's the average, so that means somewhere a little bit higher than that, but about 2,800 feet above sea level. So they're not real tall mountains, really. About 2,800 feet tall. And then the mountains of Samaria, they're lower than those in Galilee and those in Judea. They're really hills. In fact, sometimes it's called the hill country of Samaria, rather than mountains, actually. But you've got the mountains of Samaria, and sometimes they're called the mountains of Ephraim. Okay, and then in the southern portion of Palestine, the mountains of Judea. And the altitude varies from about 2,000 to 3,000 feet. The mountains of Judea. And it's actually Jerusalem is built right on those mountains. Mount Zion is a mountain and so forth. And they're not real high again. And the area right in between the mountains and right beside the Dead Sea is an extremely barren, arid area called the Judean Wilderness. That's where Christ was tempted. That's where John the Baptist spent a lot of time, as well as David fleeing from Saul there as well. And also, one other point now, and we're actually almost off of our map here. Maybe I should use this map over here. Down in the southern portion of Palestine, there's an area called the Negev, or Negev. Sometimes you'll see it spelled N-E-G-E-V, sometimes N-E-G-E-V. Sometimes it will end with a V and sometimes with a V. But the Negev is down here in the very southern portion of Palestine, right down here. And the mountains start dying out a little bit and turn into more hills. And it's extremely dry. Nothing is there. If you were to see it, it's nothing but hills, and there's nothing growing on them. Nothing. They're just barren, dirt hills. Gets extremely hot there, and it's real wilderness. And that's called the Negev. Maybe you want me to spell it for you here. So either like this, or sometimes you'll see it ending with a V, or N-E-G-E-V. Yes?
What was this area of the wilderness?
Okay, that would be this area right here, all along the Dead Sea, in between the mountains and the Dead Sea.
That's different from Negev.
Yeah, that's a little bit different. It's called the Judean Wilderness, and it is really, really a wild area. Not very much there at all. Okay, and then we come to number three. Yes. Yes. Right. Uh-huh. Sure. Uh-huh. Yeah. Now, not so much, I don't think, during the time of Christ, but during the time of the Old Testament. I think probably by the time of Jesus, probably most of that type of wildlife was gone. But earlier, like during the time of Jeremiah, like Jeremiah talked about, if you run with a horseman and they were deep, then how can you deal with... if you run with the footmen and they weary thee, then how can you contend with horses? And if in the land of peace you become weary, then how will you do in the swelling of the Jordan? And he's talking about when the Jordan would swell and the lions would come out. And that's discussed in the book of Jeremiah. So evidently during Jeremiah's time, which is, you know, 580 or so B.C., 590 B.C., there were lions then, during that time. Now, number three is the Jordan River Valley, flowing right down, of course, where the Jordan River is. And actually, there's a large valley that the Jordan River flows down. The name Jordan means the descender, the descender. And there's a name that Israel had for this particular valley. They called it the Gore, the Gore. So number three, another synonym would be the Gore, G-H-O-R, and that's the actual valley that the river flows down through. It averages about 10 miles wide, the Gore does. Now, in this valley, it was filled with semi-tropical vegetation, very difficult to cross through. It's very hot in this area, and along with the water from the Jordan River, when it would flood, there's a lot of vegetation there. It'd be very, very difficult to just walk across this valley anywhere. They had to find certain fords to cross it because of all the thick underbrush and vegetation and all the tropical, semi-tropical trees. Now, this was called the Pride of Jordan. When the Bible talks about the Pride of Jordan, it's talking about all this thick vegetation that grew along the banks of the Jordan River. And so the Jordan twists and it curves through all this thick growth of trees and scrub. And there were actually lions and other beasts that lived in this brush. And what would happen is that basically, you were pretty much safe from them until the river flooded. And then when the river flooded, the lions were chased out of the bushes. And if your house was close to where they came out of, well, then your life might be in jeopardy. And you can read of that in Jeremiah chapter 12, verse 5. Jeremiah chapter 12, verse 5. Also, Jeremiah chapter 49, verse 19. Jeremiah 49, verse 19. Now, as far as the Jordan River, it's not one of the great waterways of classical antiquity. Actually, the river itself is only about 65 miles long. That's about it. That's about from here down to Olympia, I think. Isn't Olympia about 60 miles away or so? So it's only about 65 miles long from the Sea of Galilee down to the Dead Sea. Now, that would be as a crow flies. That'd be straight in a beeline. If you followed every single bend, it'd be about 200 miles in length because it twists a lot in this valley. And actually, it starts north of the Sea of Galilee. It starts in this little lake that we'll talk about later. It starts in this little body of water, which is really a swampland called Lake Hula, or the waters of Merom, and then flows down to the Sea of Galilee, and then flows 65 miles from the bottom of the Sea of Galilee into the Dead Sea. And it does flow year-round, so it is a constant supply of water. The Sea of Galilee is about 700 feet below sea level, and the Dead Sea is 1,290 feet below sea level. So, Sea of Galilee, 700 feet below. Dead Sea is 1,290 feet. It's non-navigable. You could not. They didn't sail like ships down it or anything like that. For the most part of the year, it's too shallow. Too many sandbars, too many twists and everything. Too many natural obstructions. There was one real advantage of the Jordan River. It kept out invaders. It was very hard to get into the land of Palestine. You had to enter Palestine from the north or from the south. You could cross the Jordan River at the fords, but the fords were fairly easy to defend, see? And so you couldn't just cross it anywhere. The banks of this gorge are real steep, and sometimes they jut several hundred feet up into the air. So what we're saying is a combination of 10 miles of scrub and brush along with the cliffs make it quite an obstruction, quite a natural barrier. Okay. And then when we move on to number four, which we really don't have too much time to talk about, number four is called the Transjordan Plateau. Transjordan. The word trans means other. So we're talking about the other side of the Jordan. And as soon as you cross over the Jordan River, there's a large fertile plain here that goes from northern Palestine down to southern Palestine, which is called the Transjordan Plateau. And it also consists of rolling hills and low mountains. And there are a couple of different geographical names that are given actually to this land. Maybe I'll write those down here. It starts up in the north, up by the Sea of Galilee. It's called the Land of Bashan. And that's the northern portion of it. Right below that is the Land of Gilead. And then right below Gilead is the Land of Ammon. And then right below that is the land of Moab. Really, the thing that marks the boundaries on these areas actually are rivers. I won't take the time to list them, but the Jabbok River and the Yarmouk River and the Jared River and so forth are the rivers that mark the boundaries between these different localities. At one time, there were tribes of people that occupied these lands, like the Ammonites and the Moabites. So it starts up to the north with Bashan, and then goes to Gilead, then goes to Ammon, and then goes to Moab. And incidentally, this is a very beautiful area, really. Very fertile, very good for raising livestock and for raising cattle. And that's why the half-tribe of, who was it, Manasseh and Reuben and Gad, they desired this land instead of going into the Promised Land, because it basically looked like a pretty favorable land. Okay, well, we'll talk about this next week, next Thursday. What I needed to know, I needed to get from you, what is the exit that you turn off, I forget, to get to Kirkland?
Oh, boy.
Do you remember that?
Well, I don't know the number, but what you take is 124.
Okay,
124.
Okay, is it 124?
It's 124th Street.
Okay, 124th Street. I know it's marked real well. Do you want to use the line? No, I'm going to use it. No, I'm not. Oh, I'm not. Oh, I can't wait.